Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. As I've said to you before, and I'll explain to you every time pretty much, our goal is to bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. And I interject because I forget that this is not an axiom in my notes, and that is we also want to look how sometimes the lack of choices in our society affect today's community and what the long-term ramifications of change or lack of change can be. Our topic today is preparing to put it in the work, and we'll describe real clearly what put it in the work means in a little bit. But it's intersectionality in action. And yes, we will define that word for you, or you, if you go to Wikipedia, you probably will need the whole program to read it because there are somewhere in the neighborhood of about 6,000 words, I think, on Wikipedia to explain that word. What we're going to talk about is some interesting statistical information and how it affects our lives in some real diverse fashions. According to the U.S. Bureau of Census Bureau, San Luis Obispo County is 71% white. That's having to do with the racial makeup of our community. That's considered significantly higher than the state average, which you may not be aware of, which is just over 40%. How this reality shapes local conversations about racism and the structural nature of inequality or equality in our society and our community is a factor that we probably don't look at often. My guest today will want to help us understand and answer these questions and have a good handle on how they affect what we look at and why we look at it the way we do. I found when I was putting this together that it's a difficult topic to do a short elevator introduction to. So I will apologize for the fact that the introduction for that is really probably briefer than I wanted it to be, but that's because my guests know and understand what we're going to talk about in ways that I haven't even considered yet. With us today are Cameron Clay, and he is involved with the setup and the involvement of this project in an organization called Race Matters in San Luis Obispo County. Donna Halit, and she is a regenerative grief coach. And yes, before you ask the question to yourselves and wonder why we haven't answered it, we will explain how that fits into this topic. And Dr. Leola Dublin McMillan, she's a critical culture scholar, an essayist and consultant, and a very insightful person about what this topic is all about and why. They're putting together a series of workshops, and the one that's coming up in a little while, preparing to put in the work, intersectionality in action. The workshop is going to be presented in San Luis Obispo, and it's basically sponsored and organized by Race Matters, as I mentioned earlier. And it's going to be a conversation that hopefully will look at issues with regard to race and our community in ways that we haven't paid attention to. And you can call and be part of this discussion if you wish. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. And as I remind listeners every time I'm here, we have a lot more time to take you as part of the discussion if you don't wait until the last 10 minutes of the program and figure out you want to try and squeeze it in at the last minute. You'll help us if you want to be part of this discussion to be involved in the conversation early. I'm not quite sure where we start. Maybe we probably need to define intersectionality in action and what that is, and we probably also need to define the term put in the work, because in the syntax of English, when we use it, it can probably be construed in different fashions than it's really intended here. Who wants to jump in first with that?
I'll take a chance.
Okay, that's Dr. McMillan. Okay, jump
Dr.
on.
Dr. McMillan
it. Okay.
Will weigh in first, and then okay. I'll hand it off to Cam.
Okay.
So I will start with the title. Right? Okay. So preparing to put in the work, intersectionality in action. And if we parse that, putting in the work, right, that's a borrowing from Black vernacular, right? Like when you want something and it requires a lot of effort, you got to put that work in, right? And so we were very intentional with that title, because when you talk about building community and dismantling oppression, there is significant effort, right? And you're gonna need to put the work in, right? And so this workshop is to prepare people to put the work in. And what that work looks like is intersectionality in action. And if we think about intersectionality, it's usually not thought of in active senses, right? It's a descriptor, right, for an idea that encourages us to remember that of all the different labels that we have attached to us, none of them operate independently, right? I am Black, I am female, I'm an academic, and I can't just be Black. Wherever I am, I'm always all of those things together all at once, and I can't tease them apart and suggest that, like, something only affects one piece of my identity, right? So I can be a feminist, right? Mm-hmm. But I also have to attend to racism and my color, because as a feminist who's Black, my experience with feminism and as a woman is very different from the experience of someone who is also a feminist but doesn't experience life as a Black feminist. Is that intelligible?
That's good. That's right. Wonderful. Yes.
Right. So So that's intersectionality, okay. Right? And usually it's just used to talk about the way you look at things, not necessarily the way you do things, right? And so intersectionality in action is about us doing that work and always being mindful of intersectionality.
Yeah. And Cam, I'll give you a chance to build on that, but I wanted to not let something get away.
Okay.
Historically, the word intersectionality is tied a lot to the feminist movement.
To a particular feminist.
Okay. Oh, to a particular feminist. So that's how it became tied to the feminist movement.
Right.
Okay. Because it's now being used and looked at, and I commend you for looking at it in a broader sense in your explanation, to really apply to anyone who's trying to define where they fit or where they stand.
Right.
Okay. So I'm not quite sure why it was ever tied specifically to a feminist topic before. Wait a second. Yeah, you don't need to put your hand up and go pick me here. It's okay. I wish you were dancing. Okay. All right. Okay.
To respond to that.
Okay.
Or have
cameras. Okay. Okay. Cam, jump in.
So first off, I want to back up a little bit. Intersectionality, you asked about where it was coined. So there's a scholar, her name is Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw. She works at UCLA now, I believe, but she does all kinds of work. I mean, I couldn't begin to list her resume. She works for the UN. She works for the African American Policy Forum.
She's got a JD.
She's
a PhD.
She's a superhero.
When all else fails, yeah. Be a lawyer too. Okay.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Well, if you're going to be a Black feminist doing that kind of work,
very good point. Yeah. Okay, I'll buy that. Yeah.
So she coined this term in order to look at the ways in which Dr. McMillan described that different systems affect her, right? You know, race and gender and those sorts of things are all part and parcel of who she is, and you can't tease those out, like she was saying. Putting intersectionality into action means accounting for those things when you make things, right? So let's say, for example, let's take SLO High School District, for example, okay. Right? The state is now looking at making ethnic studies a mandatory requirement for all high schools. Certain counties have already started doing that work. Now, keeping intersectionality in mind, right, and you mentioned earlier that SLO County is 71% white. So if you're going to have ethnic studies courses in a school district and in an area where 70% of your students or the people in this demographic are white, then we also need to account for, hey, are the faculty at these schools or the staff at these schools prepared and trained to teach ethnic studies, right? Just because we're bringing in and rolling out this new curriculum, we still have to account for, A, were these teachers previously taught about these things? Where are they from? What kind of research and pedagogical training have they had? And who are they and why do they come to do this work, right? Because it's not enough to say we want to bring out ethnic studies, but we're going to just use the staff we already have and bring the PE teacher in to teach ethnic studies.
Right. You can't deploy that recklessly.
Right? So yeah, we need to okay. be, when yeah. putting it into okay. action is, okay, we want to bring ethnic studies out. Hey, Cal Poly has an ethnic studies department. Maybe we should tap them for resources and see what they're looking at, right? So it's being mindful of the greater puzzle. And I think that's what intersectionality in theory is about, but in action is being mindful of that puzzle and then figuring out workarounds to achieve the goals that you want to achieve.
Wow. Okay.
You're loving it.
I'm loving it. This is it. You know, coming into this topic, and looking at the material that the three of you shared with us beforehand to try and put it all together, it's like this is a topic that I think a lot of people will leave this program with today saying, hopefully, I don't understand a whole lot more than I came to the program listening to, but I understand a whole lot more about why I need to pay attention to what I do or don't know. Which gives me kind of a transition into Donna explaining what in the world this has to do with regenerative grief coaching.
When you start answering those questions,
yeah.
stuff's going to come up. You know, these are hard questions about different lived experiences. And I mean, like in my connection with Leola, you know, we have very different lived experiences. And, you know, it shows up, you know. And part of my work right now as a white woman, okay, we'll talk intersectionality. I'm a white woman, a middle-aged white woman. And so, you know, I don't have the same experiences. So, for example, Leola and I are going to go for a walk in my neighborhood. And she's like, okay, Dawn, I'm almost ready. I just have to go get my ID. And I'm like, your ID? It's like, I got my phones and my key. You know, my phone and my key. Why do you need your ID? I don't even think about leaving my house with my ID because I am not going to get, I mean, I've never been stopped by, you know, law enforcement of any sort in my, you know. So yeah. These kinds of things, like on the daily, these things are totally different lived experiences. So when I heard that, you know, my grief came up, you know, shock, first of all, because this is not my experience at all. And then like, whoa, what is that like to, you know, all day, every day, needing to prove who I am, prove my, you know, my credentials, prove where I've been, something date stamped, you know, have my ID with me, you know, say I have a PhD, you know, I mean, like, that's not been my experience to prove myself. The only time I had to do that was related to a death in my family where people needed to know how I was related. And that was frustrating for me. One itty bitty thing, you know, that's nothing. And so I have so much to learn here. I'm just starting to become more and more aware of it. So, I'm super aware of how it brings up my grief. And the ability to work with that emotion, well, grief is an emotion and a skill set. There's an allowing of those feelings to move through us so we can keep showing up, to not let it paralyze us and get stuck so that we can keep doing the work. Because this is, you know, we're swimming in a certain water here. This is not like, oh, we go to a workshop for a day and I'm done. You know, this is a lifetime. We're, you know, this is ubiquitous. We have this in all of our structures and our institutions. I can't even see the water I'm swimming in. So as that mirror gets reflected to me over and over again, I'm like, you know, I hit these walls of grief over and over again, and I need to keep being able to move that. And so I'm here to make space for that and to give people an opportunity to feel what they're feeling, move through it, and keep showing up.
Yeah, and I don't want to ask you to replace words you're using, but I want to interject a different word that just kind of identifies for me and see if this fits.
Mm-hmm.
Because your explanation of grief that you carry around there, and by the way, there are things that you said. I'm working real hard to not tear up based upon what you said, because there are things that I thought about related to that.
Mm-hmm.
That don't get in the way of my working through stuff. They actually, and sometimes just get in the way of doing radio because it's hard to do radio if you're crying. But If I replace the word grief with baggage, I'm not suggesting that you use that instead, but when I'm trying to identify what I'm carrying, sometimes because a lot of us have a preconceived notion of what grief is all about, we don't understand that we're working through stuff that doesn't have to do necessarily with a loss. It sometimes has to do with a void or an open space or just a lack of understanding.
Yeah. So for me, baggage has a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. So I think of it as an obstacle. I think of grief as like it gets in the way. It's actually sourced in love. So ironically, you know, it can build up. If we care, we grieve. They go hand in hand.
Yeah.
But that grief, if we don't move that energy and let it get stuck, it blocks us. So, I just wouldn't use those words. But do use a broader definition of grief. Grief, and I refer to Francis Weller's work. He wrote a book called The Wild Edge of Sorrow. And he talks about five gates of grief. And they include things like, you know, we lose everything that we love, parts of ourselves that haven't known love. So there may be parts of ourselves that we have stuffed aside, that we've, you know, put in the shadows. That's a form of grief. Ancestral grief. Our people did some stuff, and that's handed down literally through our DNA. The sorrows of the world, huge, you know, like, and people don't even notice that. And then another one is that we didn't get what we expected. And that's a little amorphous, and what it really is the loss of the village. You know, when we were born, we expected through our DNA to be greeted by a village. We didn't have that, and so we don't have the village to acknowledge all the transitions in our life and things of this sort. So it's that isolation factor that we're not always aware of. It's broad.
She's amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
hot sauce.
I guess I want to pre-apologize because this may not fit in the discussion, but as you were saying that, it occurred to me that in my mind, one of my big concerns about our society is, and you talked about the village that we would like to have for support. We've historically as a society, or maybe as all Homo sapiens, traded that village concept for our tribe. Okay. My pat answer, this is going to come across arrogant, but I'm going to do it anyway. Okay. When people ask me about, you know, they argue with me about my view of the world, which is really pretty all-inclusive. And they say, well, we've all got tribes and we've all got people we fit into and stuff like that. I say, wait a second. I can't see the edge of my tribe, and it's very important to me that I never see the edge of my tribe. Then I don't ever have to define one, because as far as I'm concerned, there is no edge of my tribe. But I can tell you, I get deer in headlights looks from people on a regular basis when I try and explain that concept. Mm. Because some of the most socialistic organizations in the world are very conservative because they're only socialistic for their tribe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When we start looking at whether or not the tribe is everybody, for some people, being socialistic isn't a problem. And I apologize if I'm running this discussion in the wrong direction.
Nope. Okay. Look at the smile on our faces. But
the smile on your face, I appreciate that. The smile on your face could have been, he's old and he's getting real clueless on us.
Hearing you say things that I have said and hearing you say things that created a very clear pathway to talk about the work that we do and the way in which we do it. Mm-hmm. I have a dear friend here on the Central Coast. Her name is Vivian Levy. Hi, Viv. She's a saucy social justice activist of a certain age. And we were talking a few weeks ago, and she's like, you know what the problem is? You know, we don't really have community. We just have a bunch of tribes. And I was like, yes, this is the problem. And this is a generalization, but everybody is concerned about their own tribe, and nobody wants to know that the tribe next door is suffering or doesn't have what they need. And for me, that is so painful to observe because it's so unnecessary, right? There is no reason that San Luis Obispo County doesn't feel like a welcoming and inclusive place for everyone that lives here. It's preposterous. Like, we don't really have a dearth of resources relative to the rest of the world. And yet, there are people who go without things that they need in this community because they don't belong to the right tribe. When we teach this, part of the magic of the way we teach this is we start by explaining the notion of fictive kinship, because that's how we operate as an organization, as individuals, in the work that we do together, but also individually. And fictive kinship is it's an African-American cultural retention, and it comes from the era during slavery when you had Black people in this country who had been ripped and torn apart from their families and then placed into very close proximity with other people. And so they formed kinship structures to mirror the ones that were taken from them, but they were fictive. And we still do that in Black culture, right? So we have play cousins, or my play auntie, or she's my grandma, but she's not really my grandma. that sort of stuff. And so I bring that into the classroom.
You should have been raised Jewish. Okay. I was.
Fun
okay.
fact, here's a fun fact, okay. And something that we talk about in our workshops. I was raised Jewish because I grew up racially Black, but I grew up in a Jewish community. So ethnically, Jewish girl here, yeah. Right?
Okay.
And so, again, and that's part of that intersectionality piece, right? You see how I looped
it
back?
Yeah, and I'm making an assumption, and I'll be careful, that having that interconnectedness of those two parts of your life.
Also, I was raised by Muslim, like Black Muslim
okay.
parents, so
okay.
yeah.
Well, anyway, but the fact that all those folks were talking to each other mm-hmm. gave you a benefit that a lot of us don't get.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay? I like living on the Central Coast. I love living here, but I really like going back to L.A., where I came from, uh-huh. and I also like going to visit the places in Oakland that I've been to because the food is better and the attitude's better.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
But a lot of people don't have an effective way of saying, I can have all those parts of my life and none of them really bump into each other.
Right.
Because they don't need to bump into each other.
No. Right.
But we spend a lot of time bumping them into each other.
Mm-hmm. We waste a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, just hold on a second, because I get in big trouble if I don't give a commercial here in some way. Anyway, I want to remind you, this is Central Coast Voices, and the phone number, if you want to be part of the discussion, is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. If you want to be part of this discussion, please jump in. It's something that we'd like you to be talking about with us. It's a topic that's fascinating. And it's probably fascinating because we're looking at different ways to understand it. Historically, my understanding of how Western society looks at minority culture is, bad choice of words, but I'll use it anyway, throwing cookies out to try and tell you we can help you figure out a way to be economically more viable. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be all tied to money. Okay. And I think that may be something that gets in the way of realizing for a lot of people that it's, you know, I was raised in the 60s and the word bootstrap was used a lot for everything. Yeah. Okay. Oh, the smiles went away. Okay. I didn't invent it. I just had to live around that word.
It's still around.
Okay. It's still around. Yeah. Okay. So what your workshops are looking at these kind of challenges in life differently than they've been historically looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want to oversimplify it.
No worries.
What's different?
So the first thing that's different is we start with this notion of fictive kinship, right? Because if we imagine ourselves not just to be community, but to be family, that changes the way in which we interact, right? If you and I are family members, we have a bond, we have shared connections, and that allows us to be open and honest and vulnerable with each other safely in a way that we wouldn't necessarily be with a stranger, right? And so when we are setting up kind of the ground rules for how the work will proceed and for how we will engage with each other, we make that clear from the onset. And I use that in the classroom. I use that everywhere because I haven't found that people are rebuffed by that idea. And it really begins the process of stripping away some of the fear of the unknown, of like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know how this is going to go. I hope she's not going to call me a racist. It's probably going to be painful. It's going to be so ouchy. Well, it's not, because now we're cousins.
Okay.
It's fine.
Okay.
I would like to add a little bit to that. We also create a space in which we're all co-learners, mm-hmm. right? Pedagogically, we fall under the school of Paulo Freire. I'm butchering that name.
Freire.
Yeah, my Portuguese is trash. but we, in the idea that we are learning together, right? None of us are coming to this work and being like, we have all the answers, mm. right? If we were doing that, there wouldn't be any work to be done because we could just go do what needed to be done and it'd be over. Problem solved on Tuesday.
Yeah, I got you. But if you thought you had all the answers, I'd probably stop listening to you.
Right.
Because the delivery of the answers would probably just be like, wait a second, this guy is way too arrogant for me right. to pay attention to.
Right. And so okay. I want to go back to something you mentioned a second ago, keeping that in mind too, though, is this notion of that we can solve things with money and aid, right? It's the idea that we can be benefactors and just supply money mm. or supply goods, right? And that will help those people raise themselves up. Well, that... You're taking on the assumption that all they need is this, and you know what they need for themselves better than they know what they need. And you didn't even ask them what they needed or what they wanted or if they valued what you had to offer them.
Ooh,
necessarily,
say that
right?
a little
And
louder.
So that's why we're all about being co-learners, right? Because when we come into spaces, right, we do a lot of consulting work. I also do some consulting work for a research and education and advocacy group. When we go into spaces and we're working with whether it be county services, social services, or students, high school students, college students, we always make a point to make sure that they understand that they're experts on their own lived experiences, right? There's certain expertise that we have in our respective fields, but in terms of their own lived experiences, they know best, right? So we can give them the definitions, the terms, we can talk about general, broader concepts, but they also know how X, Y, and Z are affecting them in their particular circumstances or community better than we would, right? So it's important that we also position ourselves as not on some hierarchical structure where we're the experts and you don't know anything and you come here, get from us, and then you leave and go home. So, yeah.
Wow, okay.
You can't wait to come to that workshop. Ooh-wee, I can
actually,
tell.
Well, actually, it's the middle of Live Oak, and I'll be someplace else for the first one, but we'll talk about the second one. Yeah, sorry. but, yeah, I'd like to be there. And we'll talk about how you get to be there if you want to at some point. It's – when you live in a society where – let's go back to the 71-40% thing, mm-hmm. okay? If I live in a society where I'm only 40% of the broadest definition of the population, mm-hmm. I can see my surroundings and understand how they're different. Good, different, bad, different, that's not a judgment call. It's mm-hmm. just how they happen to be structured. Okay. When I live in a community that is as predominantly white as we're talking about here, I think for some people, even if they are functioning on the positive, supportive side of what needs to be addressed, it's not that the minority population is invisible. It's just that I got to work harder to see where they are and connect with them, and that gets in the way of building that. Removal of boundary system, for lack of a better way of putting it. So I don't know how we address the fact that you have a lot of people in this community who don't think they have any prejudices, don't think that there's anybody in their community other than the nondescript homeless person of unknown gender mm-hmm. or unknown race. Mm-hmm. So it makes it really easy to kind of pretend there's no problem.
Right. Right. I would say it's very easy to lend too much weight to the numbers. I think they're important, but I think far more important than how many non-white people we have in this community, far more important is how do we treat the non-white people in this community, right? Because I've been the only black person in the room and been totally fine with it because I was comfortable, I felt welcome, and I felt included, right? The numbers matter for those of us who are in the teeny group when we don't feel safe, when we don't feel welcome, when we don't feel included, when we don't feel valued, when we don't feel seen and heard. And so there's nothing inherently wrong with San Luis Obispo being 71% white.
Right.
Right? If the other 29% enjoyed the same types of access and resources and experiences as that 71%, there would be no problem whatsoever. We don't, right? And part of that stems from the fact that we live in a society that's structured so that if you are white, you're not supposed to notice the inequality, right? Why would you? Why would you be looking for it?
It's sort of what
Donna was saying about
earlier.
You don't see what you're swimming in.
Yeah, you don't see what you're swimming in, right? Yeah. Fish don't know they're in water until they're out of water. And, well, I mean, we can't think for fish, but, you know.
Speaking for all of the fish.
Yeah, right.
Hi, Poseidon.
Well, okay, so we'll do a rebuttal program from fish later on. Okay, all right. Okay.
Well, really, this is, for me personally, this is one of the reasons why this workshop was so important for me, because I started looking at doing this work, and it's like, I can't do it in isolation. Like, if I'm looking at the question, you know, how do I benefit from white privilege? It's like, if I'm sitting in a room by myself, you know, looking at a piece of paper, asking this question, it's like, I actually don't know. But when I start hearing stories and, you know, then I can go, oh, nobody's ever followed me while I was shopping thinking that I'm going to be stealing something.
Right. You should tell the origin story of this workshop, Donna.
Well, I like how you tell it, Lula.
Okay. Well, we don't have time for you to argue about it. Donna, your pick.
Okay. Well, you know, we were at my house and hadn't seen Leola for a while, so she came on over and we ended up having a slumber party. And I was talking about this kind of work, and I was referring to some things that I saw on Instagram around a woman named Layla Saad, that she was doing some me and white supremacy work. And I was checking that out, and I was talking to Leola about it and saying, you know, I really want to do this work, but this is, I actually need something to bump up against, and I want to do this in community. And so we started having these questions and started brainstorming and went from sitting on the couch to
jumping up and running to the dining room table and grabbing laptops and being like, oh my God, this is happening. Yeah. We're doing it right now.
We created it. We co-created it. Yeah. Yeah.
When you've looked at it, what is it that this is directed to you, Donna?
Mm-hmm.
Even though I started before we did the program, said I really didn't direct questions very much and give you more of an
overview. No pressure.
But as the white lady at the table, I'm sorry. Okay.
<It's>
anyway.
So cool.
Okay. No, and that's really okay.
So good.
Anyway, okay. At what point did you look at whether or not your view of who you are in relation to people who are different? And I don't need to define what I mean. Any different at all? Okay, super tall people. You're rather slim. Obese people. Okay, people who are frail versus people who are very active. Okay, so you look at your. At what point did you start looking at whether or not the differences weren't just, you know, wow, it's cool, we're different, so we're all getting together and we're different, but that they were things to address as to whether or not they were barriers?
That's a good question.
Wow.
We're going to use that in the workshop. Thanks.
Well, you know.
Nothing I say is copyrighted.
I don't
okay.
know. And, I asked myself, like, how did I show up this way? You know, like empathy is a huge thing for me, and I grew up with that. And I feel like this is a lot of what's missing is teaching empathy. So, you know, I mean, that's like been part of my makeup. So it's been easy for me to have, I get heart connected to people. Mm-hmm. And so I see their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I hear a story, and I've always loved stories, so I like hearing people's stories that are different. And I really have no problem showing emotion and crying. I don't know if that'll happen today, but chances are good. So, you know, these are things that, you know, have just been part of my makeup. So, you know, when I bump up against that, I don't know, I go to the human thing, and I step in it, you know? I mean, it's all of that. It's all of that. And like, for me personally, the grief piece is what transcends the tribe and goes to what is it to be human? And so, like, you know, I've done communal, I'm talking communal grief rituals. I'm not just talking about, like, sitting in a room crying by yourself. This is like, you know, this is community building. When you've gone to, a ceremony like that with people, you know, you have a relationship. So this is why this is also a really important piece of this community building, is to actually grieve together so we can see what it is to be fully human, because that does transcend our differences. But we also must have a lot of respect for differences in shared life experiences and pause to hear the stories, mm-hmm. you know, be quiet and listen.
That's huge.
Wow, that is huge. Yes, that was a good word for that. Thank you.
I told you she's amazing.
Yeah. I was thinking about the comparisons for myself, because this one will get me in big trouble. A lot of stuff does. Anyway, I really do perceive my view of the world personally to not have boundaries and not have prejudices, but we all carry them whether we like it or not. Because I live in a Tascadero. Okay, there.
It's so hot.
Okay, yeah. I had to put air conditioning. Anyway, but I mean, if you think the county is predominantly white, you ought to go to a Tascadero.
We have.
So okay. So with the exception of going to the one local business that I like that happens to be owned by a black family.
Oh, Penny's Place.
Hush Harbor Bakery.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah. Penny.
Yeah, anyway. I walk in there, I'm not surprised to see black people because it's owned by black people, okay? I walk into just another shop somewhere in town.
Whiskey and June.
Okay. I actually don't go to Whiskey and June. I'm sorry.
Black people don't either.
That was. I have. You stopped me in my tracks with that one. Sorry. Anyway.
It's a
gift. Okay. Well. Just, that was. You did it again. Okay. By the way, I'm sitting here listening to a black educator talking about mitzvahs. It was just kind of a strange use of words. Okay. Let me try and get back to this anyway. If I walk into an establishment where there is a person who I've never met before, and there's a lot of Hispanics, so those are less noticeable, but they're black, okay? I do not feel like I have any fear of them, any discomfort with them, but it's startling. And that startle makes me uncomfortable, because I then question whether or not my being startled is some racial undertone that I don't understand. Now, I got to give the flip to this, which Cam will understand possibly. If I walk into the Buttercup Cafe in Oakland and I see 7 black people and 2 of them are cops, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Because I'm in the middle of Oakland and they aren't even noticed. So I'm wondering whether or not this community that's predominantly white makes it harder for us to feel like everybody fits together, because the person who's different is such an anomaly on a daily basis.
Mm. I think that, once again, speaks to climate, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Sitting back like I'm hosting the show. I can't go anywhere. I think that
we want you to be heard. Okay.
I think it really speaks to climate, right? Because we make such a big deal about race and racial difference,
go ahead.
And because folks don't tend to leave their tribes, right? That precedent hasn't been set yet in this community, then it is jarring. It is startling. And I will say this, it's not indicative necessarily of something that's problematic with you, because the black people in this community are also startled when we go places and see other black people. We're always like, oh snap, unicorn.
Yeah, yeah, so some homie I've never met before. Okay,
hey,
yeah.
Okay. What's yeah. up? And so let that startle response happen, right? And be aware of it, but also recognize that that's a human being who probably wants to be seen and heard, and just like, you'd be surprised how many people don't think that, like, it's okay for them to make eye contact and say hello. Like, we talked about that in the first workshop.
Oh, yeah. Just don't be weird about
yeah.
it.
I talk to everybody.
So do
okay.
I.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's one of the things I notice is I notice kids.
All the time.
And I notice kids. I especially notice kids. I may not notice that there is a couple that is of mixed race or ethnicity mm-hmm. until I look at their kid. Mm-hmm. And my first reaction is, and I'm not suggesting we have to get everybody blended together, but my first reaction is all of the mixed race kids I look are beautiful, see are beautiful. They just inherently look good, okay? And don't throw anything across the desk at me, but it's...
I know some ugly okay.
Kim and I both know some that are not stutters.
Let's not make that generally. Okay. I just want to say, I just thought about something you said with that. Just around like surprise and seeing kids and that sort of thing, right? Yeah. So I lived here for a number of years. Being a black man, hiking Bishops or anywhere around here, right? It's a lot of nature. And I would come across people and I see that look of shock on their face, right? There's who's this black guy with dreadlocks hiking on the side of the mountain next to me. That's fine to be surprised at that, right? Because if I saw another black person hiking on Bishops, I'm like, hey, how you doing? Like, what's up? What's going on? Right? But the fact that sometimes we can't imagine that those people exist or manifestations of different people exist is kind of a problem to a certain extent. And that's when we look at ourselves and are like, hey, what's going on? But also to tie in the little kids piece I want to talk about is, so on the side of the mountain, those same people that are afraid to speak to me on the side of the mountain or show that shock of fear, right? I'll say hello. I'm a very friendly person. I was taught that you recognize people's humanity and dignity, and the way that you do that when you're walking down the street and you're the only person on the street is to say hello to that person, yeah. right? So we're on the side of a mountain and I say hello to you and you look and keep on walking like, are you okay? Like, what's wrong with you, right? Now, imagine, right, and this has happened throughout my life, and I can speak to, I mean, there's plenty of people of color that can say this too. You're a parent, and you're walking with your children, and I speak to you, and you don't speak to me, and you show indifference or fear.
You're communicating.
Your child.
Telegraphing, yeah.
Your child yeah. watches that too, and I watch children all the time look up at their parents and see that their parents show fear towards a black man, and that kid is watching their parents, and that kid internalizes that as well, right? And not to say that I expect everyone to speak to me, like, none of that. It's just that those sort of things is, that's intersectionality in action, right? Because if that parent knows that that child is watching them and watching their reactions, they're going to make sure that they're very thoughtful about the moves that they make and the things that they do and the way that they treat people of their community, right? Because that is how subliminally that child learns, oh, I should be afraid of them with no experience, no knowledge, no reason for doing it, right? That message is clearly communicated to that child.
Yeah. That's a very good point, and I've got a hint for you.
Yeah.
Say hello to the child first and
I
they
always
get a different
yeah,
reaction.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I
yeah.
do it
definitely,
all the time.
Yeah. It took me some while to learn that, but yeah, yeah. you say hi to a kid first, it's good. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I do it deliberately yeah. well, because I want children to become familiar with interacting in pleasant ways with someone who looks like me. So I'll see little kids and I compliment them on their shoes or their shirt or give them a high five all the time. And the parents are usually like, what? And I'm like, you should have been doing this work. You're welcome.
Yeah, and I have not always, but generally done that, even though I have grandchildren who think I'm just weird. But
yeah.
Like, okay,
I mean,
grandpa who sneezes like an elephant. Anyway, But sometimes it it works as a tool. Mm-hmm. Okay, one of the tools is because if I'm looking at you and you're different, and I'm in, and in my mind I'm really admiring this mixed ethnicity couple of some kind and mm-hmm. a beautiful child. Sometimes the look the parents may get is that old white dude over there, and that may not be the word they use, but anyway, is just looking at us and what is his problem? So if I talk to the child first, mm-hmm. I'm able to convey a different attitude, mm-hmm. which oftentimes starts something which I love, which is great conversations with strangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I wasn't born as twins or triplets, so other than my parents, everybody's always been, it was a stranger at some point. They had to start out. I mean, mm-hmm. I did not know any of you before we walked in the room today.
That's a pity.
And it is, because I did not feel at all like, oh, this is going to be a really strange show and hard to talk about. It's like, no, this is going to be very positive and connected, which probably is because we're running a little short on time. We probably need to at least talk about
the actual workshop
and what's possible with that. Yeah.
Someone other than me want to take the lead? No? You guys.
Okay. Come on.
We've got our next two workshops are scheduled for the 22nd and 29th of June. We are in the process of finalizing venues. They will be in the county, but we're really trying to have them not all be in SLO, because what I've noticed over the last decade or so mm-hmm. that I've been in this community is that we act as if the only city in San Luis Obispo County is San Luis Obispo. And we've got people that live north and south of SLO. And, you know, if we're talking about being intentional and welcoming and working to accommodate people, we can't do that work with any real integrity if we say, like, oh, you live in Cambria? Too bad. You're driving to SLO today. You live in AG? Too bad. And so we're finalizing the venues, but June 22nd and June 29th, we'll be having the next two workshops. Okay.
We need to jump in quick because we have people who want to talk to us already.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Margie from Avila Beach. Margie, you don't have a whole lot of time, but I want you to be part of the discussion.
Okay.
You're on the air.
Oh, I want always to say hello to people who are different than me, all white. Me. I always feel like maybe I'm being patronizing by speaking to them like, oh, aren't I a nice person? Oh. I'm saying hello to you. You're black or you're transgender or something like that. I want to be able to do that. I really do. And I don't know how a person of that difference from the white would react to that. Maybe I should not care. Maybe I should just go ahead and do it.
Yeah, Dr. McMillan would like to answer for you, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Sure.
And thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
First, I would like to say hi, Margie. and what I'll say is, don't worry about how it's received. You can't. Worry about your intention and where that's coming from and the purity of your heart. I tell people all the time that if there was a word that described me, it would be love. And I imagine myself walking through the world with this bottomless basket of love, and I offer it to everyone that I meet. And sometimes people don't want it, and that's fine. It goes back in the basket, and maybe down the road I'm going to meet someone who's going to need a double helping anyway. And so it doesn't get wasted, right? And if you make the effort, even if people misinterpret it, because that's always a possibility, right, you can feel good about who you are and the work that you're doing. And that's what we can focus on.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Okay. All right, let's see. Julie in San Luis Obispo. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, Julie.
Hi there. Thank you for talking about this subject. I didn't get to the first when it started, but I have a story to tell you. And the reason I'm doing this, I'm telling it on the air because I hope many people would hear it. When I was working in East Africa, I was working in a prestigious school, English only, and was run by Canadian Jesuits, and I had 7 different nationalities in my class. And so the light-skinned ones would pick on the dark skin one or the ugly one or whatever. And we were allowed to discipline students the way we see fit. It didn't work. Go get your parents and so on and so forth. So one day I went home and I'm saying, what am I going to do with this? 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and something said to me, that is my mind, you know how you think. Boil 2 eggs and take them to class. So a few days later, I did boil 2 eggs, took them to class, held them up, and said, what is this? Eggs? Okay, who wants to? I want to peel them. 2 students peeled the eggs. They go back to your seat. Then I held the eggs again. And I said, can you tell me? You will have a reward. Okay. Which one was the brown one and which one was the white one?
Julie, I'm going to have to probably cut off the story because we really don't have enough time to discuss the story further. So you may want to call in next time we talk about the subject.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Okay. We're like a lot of people do. They wait till the end of the program to call, and we run a little short on time for them. And as you all know, I try and make sure in the last part of the program that all of my guests get a couple of minutes to basically cover the things that I left out of this topic. And I can tell you, based upon my notes and the how fast the hour has gone, I've probably left at least two-thirds of what we should be talking about out of here. Cam, I'm going to start with you. What do you want to make sure we don't forget from talking about this today?
I want to make sure that folks recognize that this work isn't isolated to necessarily a certain region or, you know, just SLO. I mean, this kind of stuff is important worldwide, but oftentimes people try to solve all the world's problems before they worry about what's going on in their own house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important, is to like figure out what's going on where you're at and try to work on that sometimes, right? Because the world's got problems, we all know that. But if you're trying in your own community, building up your own community sometimes builds chain reactions and other people see, hey, what are they doing over there? That looks cool, let's try that out, right? And worrying about yourself before you worry your own, before you go and worry about everyone else. Sometimes you work things out a little bit quicker than you thought you were, and there's less enemies, or, as you say, to go out and deal with, right? You worry about what's going on in your own house, getting your own house in order. I mean, I think that's key.
That's a good point, and I suspect you'll follow up on that with the workshop if people decide to go, and they should.
Definitely.
Yeah,
okay.
Should.
Definitely.
Yeah. Donna.
You know, these are times where we really need to work together. We need to collaborate. We need to, come together as a local group, and that's going to be happening more and more and more. So this ability to, you know, create community, a beloved community, to work through our issues, to see one another as truly human. That's what we're here to do, and that's what this workshop is all about, and this is where that grief piece is really super important to help build community and keep showing up.
Yeah. Thank you. Well put, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. McMillan, you get the last word.
Thank you, sir.
Because I think you like having the last word.
I don't.
No.
That's a lie. I really love it. I want to encourage people, even if they don't feel like the workshop is for them, to just suspend judgment and be curious and try. Just come see what it's about. Yeah. You know, it feels a lot like this, right? Mm-hmm. You hang out with some cool new neighbors, talk about some serious stuff, tell a few jokes, cry a little bit, hug it out. It's a good time, yeah. Right? Because this work is hard, but it doesn't have to be painful, right? And we try and make it.
Yeah, none of you have made this discussion today painful.
Well, why should it be?
Well, but my hunch is there are people who are very capable of making it painful,
yeah,
and making it sound just as logical as it was today.
Yeah. You start from a place of love. You start from a place of love.
Yeah. You want to remind us again how you get information about the workshop?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me because I got nervous and I forgot our Race Matters website.
Well,
but it's on the race.
You can Google pretty much anything
right.
that will work.
So the workshop name again is Preparing to Put in the Work, Intersectionality in Action. We are holding one on June 22nd from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And again on the 29th of June from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Those locations have not been finalized yet, but you can find out about them on the Race Matters website. You can find out, I believe, on the websites of some of our partner organizations. So Gala of the Central Coast, the Slow Women's March, Race Matters has a Facebook page as well. So you can get that information. We'd love to see you.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I've got to say that that most of the time when this topic comes up for both on this program and this topic, any kind of topic like this comes up on this program or in our community, there seems to be a preoccupation with them and us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I want to thank you for not making this about them and us. I wasn't expecting you to make it about them and us, but I think you created a good example of why it doesn't have to be them and us.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, a rather them and us society.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
It's a paradigm shift. That's what we're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate it. This has been Central Coast Voices. I want to thank you all for being with us today. I realize some of you may be at Live Oak this coming weekend when their workshop is, but I can also tell you that word is out that Full Fest Live Oak tickets are sold out already. So if you're not doing something on Saturday, that is the 22nd, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, and you can't get to Live Oak because there are no tickets left available, you might want to consider doing something constructive like this. Not trying to imply you're competing with us or we're competing with you from that standpoint, but it's reality. You'll get some people that have something to do. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be with you, and because she won't be at Live Oak and I will. We're not quite sure what's all going to be on her program next week, but please join her, same time, same place. Remind you again that that Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. I want to thank Joan Gellert Sargent for her underwriting of the program. I want to remind you that you can contact us at voices@kcbx.org or by phone at 805-543-2323. I want to thank KCBX for co-sponsoring this program with us. And I want to thank my guests today, which were Cameron Clay, Donna Hewlett, and Dr. Leola Dublin McMillan, because I think this has been a great discussion. This has been Central Coast Voices. Stick around for This American Life coming up next on KCBX.